This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. As kids, we're taught an abbreviated history of the colonial period, a little bit on the Mayflower, a short lesson on the Salem witch trials, and of course, the story of the first Thanksgiving. Now, writer and editor Jason Rodriguez is re-examining the era with an unusual collection called Colonial Comics, New England, 1620 to 1750. From Thomas Morton, Mary Mount's Lord of Misrule, to the story of Eunice Williams, a colonist captured and raised by Native Americans, this illustrated collection, which Jason edited, opens up underappreciated stories from New England's rich colonial history. And Jason Rodriguez, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much, Taylor. Thank you for having me.
So you are also involved with another collection called District Comics, an unconventional history of Washington, D.C. Now, is there something about exploring history through visual imagery that really resonates with you?
Oh, I definitely think so, Taylor. There is this sense of context that you get with comic books that you don't really get when you just read a history text. So when someone is taking in a comic book and looking at a panel, they have the option to slow down their pace, look at the clothes that people were wearing, the environment, the time of day, a lot of things that you don't normally get by just telling someone, you know, George Washington crossed the Delaware River. When you see the picture, you get a lot more of the visual cues and context associated with it. I mean, I used to love when I was a kid, whenever you read about the American Revolution, it always starts with these war maps, you know, and they would follow the dotted line, and you would follow, you know, this army went to this bridge and fought over this river, and it really kind of put the entire battle into perspective, so then you could dig more into the minutia. So comic books affords that as well, and allows you to really, you know, appreciate the bigger picture before getting into the tinier details.
Now, each separate story here, each vignette, features its own writer and illustrator. Now, what is the advantage of having this broken up and being done by a number of people rather than just one writer and illustrator throughout?
Well, I think it actually helps to bring in a lot of histories that I wouldn't think about as a writer, for sure. A lot of these stories came to me from people who just happened to know this little interesting bit of history, or something where I actually discovered a person like Elizabeth Glover, who brought the first printing press, and I went to a writer and said, hey, can you find out more? Erica Swiler in this case. And she did a really great job of finding probably more than I would have been able to do on my own if I was writing all 17 of these stories. It also allows you to bring in these more famous historians who wrote great history text about topics that aren't normally covered in the, you know, K-12 curriculum, and they're experts in the field, and they don't need to do all this extensive research, so they could really put together a story for you that is much more robust than something you could do on your own.
And the one that you just mentioned, Elizabeth Glover and the first printing press, that's one of those stories that sounds, you know, sort of quaint at heart, a classic colonial story, but there's some really big implications there. Can you tell us a little bit more about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. I came across Elizabeth Glover when I was just looking up names of people that I didn't know, essentially, from the period.
Right.
And the only thing I knew about her, as mentioned, is that she brought the first printing press to America. So I talked to a writer friend of mine, Erica Swiler, and asked her if she could, you know, dig a little deeper. And it turns out that Elizabeth Glover's husband was actually the first person to attempt to bring a printing press over, but he died en route. So Elizabeth Glover was left with two of his essentially indentured servants, two people who owed a debt to him, a bunch of kids, and a printing press, and really no means to set up a business to use this printing press. So she had to rely on her husband's debtors to actually set up and run the shop and be the public face of the shop. She was relying pretty strongly on Harvard opening up and bringing them business, and Harvard's opening was delayed. So she was a bit of an entrepreneur, and she just started printing books. The Besson book was the first book printed in America, and it was printed in her shop. It was riddled with errors, which was actually kind of funny. But eventually Harvard opened, and she got into a relationship with the headmaster of the school and bought lots of land. And it scales up to this story. It started with, all I know is this woman bought a printing press over, and it scaled up to the story about women business owners and indentured servitude and the history of Harvard. There was so much more there that really kind of brought out this new story that I never expected when I just gave her this one-line description of what I wanted.
Now, how does one go about editing comics? I guess compared especially to more conventional editing that we think of with a novel or nonfiction.
It's a very detailed process, to say the least. I'm a very hands-on editor, so I like to start from the very basic grand, like little germ of a story, and help the writer develop it into this full piece. So I request scripts, and then when we get artists working on it, I request basically storyboards or thumbnails, and then pencils, and then inks, and then colors, and then every step has an approval process to it. On top of that, there's a certain vision that I like to put on top of books, and I like to make them feel like a more cohesive anthology. So there's a lot of oversight. There's a lot of managing various creators. I had 33 people in this book. And on top of that, I'm so hands-on that I actually designed the entire book as well, because I had a very specific vision for it, and I wanted to make sure that it came out the way that I thought would work best.
I'm speaking with Jason Rodriguez. He's editor of Colonial Comics, New England, from 1620 to 1750. One of my favorite stories from the collection, Jason, is about how livestock became a focal point for growing tensions between colonists and Native Americans. Now, this is a really interesting story because it doesn't really have any dialogue. You know, there's no speech bubbles. It's all told through pictures. And it's another relatively short story with big implications.
That was one of the first ones I started to work on when I started putting this collection together. And I read Virginia the John Anderson's wonderful book, Creatures of Empire, which was about the implications of free-range animal husbandry, which is, as you said, a very difficult topic to tackle. So I found her email address. I wrote her. And I said, have you ever thought about creating a comic book about free-range animal husbandry suitable for middle schoolers and high schoolers?
And she said, yes, I've been thinking about that forever.
Yeah, she's been thinking about it her entire life. No, she obviously she never even thought about it once. But through a couple of emails and phone calls, we figured out what a story like this would look like. We decided to make it silent because, you know, one of the main issues was communication. A lot of these Native Americans, they didn't know what livestock was. They hadn't seen livestock until the colonists brought them over. And there was these difficulties in communicating the purpose of livestock of sorts, and the fact that these livestock needed all this land, so they would go out and they would eat all the Native American crops, and tensions would escalate, essentially. So we wanted to capture that lack of real communication by making the story silent, and it took a tremendous artist like Mike Seeger to really bring that to life, and I think it works fantastically, and it scales up. So it's the kind of story that a younger reader can appreciate, and as you get older, you start to appreciate more of the nuances and how this isn't just a story about a couple of pigs eating crops. This is really a story about one of the foundational issues between these two cultures that intersected.
You know, were you thinking early on, I could see this, you know, being put in schools, I could see this being used for classroom use, or did that just sort of spring up on its own?
No, it was definitely the intention from the beginning. When I was talking to my publisher at Fulcrum, that was what we wanted to do. We wanted something that could be enjoyed by adults, but something that also would get kids interested in history, essentially, by showing them some of the stories that they're not necessarily familiar with. So it was always part of the plan. I tried to strengthen that direction a bit. After the American Library Association, I talked to a bunch of librarians and educators and tried to figure out what they would want from a book like this. But I do know that there is one school in Chicago that actually used the free-range animal husbandry story, since it is silent, to teach their kids about inferencing and look at artwork and figure out what's being shown and what's actually the intention behind the artwork. So I know that's certainly happening. I know there are a lot of teachers. On Twitter, I see some social study teachers talking about it at one point and saying how it's a great tool. So that's good. And I've also talked to some homeschoolers who are interested in using this in their curriculums with their kids moving forward. So although it's only been a month, I'm getting some pretty positive feedback, and I'm very excited about that.
Well, Jason, one of the things I've noticed, the first Thanksgiving is definitely absent from this collection.
Yeah, it was actually when we were putting together this book and we were just writing down stories to include, it seemed so obvious to include something on the first Thanksgiving and the true story of the first Thanksgiving. And I think as we started finding these smaller stories that were more, I think, people focused, it just sort of dropped out because the narratives that focused on the individuals just tended to be much more exciting, I think, than the story of the first Thanksgiving. So that was one of the ones that went away along with several other stories so that we could focus on some of the more interesting people, I think.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
Jason Rodriguez is the editor of Colonial Comics. You can find a link to his website and more about the collection at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. And join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.